Hey everybody, it's Eugene here, and welcome to Forensics Talks. This is episode 90, and September is absolutely flying by, and I always feel like September is where the pedal goes to the metal, and things are really picking up and moving fast. So anyway, hopefully you're all doing well, and here we go. So our guest today, as you probably saw, is Stephen Jameson. Now, Steve is a native of Charleston, South Carolina. He graduated from Roger Williams University in 1999 with a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Technology. He started his career in the U.S. Navy, and his operational assignments have included a full range of duties in the Naval Special Warfare community. He graduated Basic Underwater Demolition School in September 1988 and spent 11 years on active duty. During his last years on active duty, Steve attended school at Roger Williams University in Bristol, Rhode Island, and on the side became certified as a commercial hard hat diver. After receiving his undergrad, Steve entered into service with the CIA, Directorate of Operations, and he subsequently left the CIA after 9/11 and became a government contractor, assisting the U.S. government on sensitive projects and missions for the next 10 years. In September of 2009, he reaffiliated with the U.S. Navy through the Navy Reserves and was assigned to SEAL Team 18, where he presently serves and is currently a chief warrant officer. Steve entered into duty with the FBI under the Critical Incident Response Group as a crisis management specialist and special mission planner for the Counter Improvised Explosive Device Section, National Asset Response Unit in September 2010. And after 4 years of training, teaching, and running exercises, Steve moved over to the lab division, where he now sits as the supervisor over the Technical Design and Documentation Program under the Operational Projects Unit, and he's the OPU Operational Coordinator. So lots to talk about with Steve. Let me bring him in here.
That was a mouthful.
Yeah, lots of stuff going on there, Steve. Lots of stuff for sure. But hey, man, thanks for being here. And yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. And also I want to say thank you to Tracy for making this happen too.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Let's see. I'm just trying to think back. I believe the first time we actually met face to face, it would have been probably in Atlanta at the IFSM? I'm not sure.
Okay, I think it was Nashville.
Oh, maybe it was Nashville.
Yeah, it was Nashville.
Okay. I remember going to dinner someplace, and I remember there's a whole group of us going to dinner, and I think we sat beside each other and we chatted away for a bit. So maybe it was Nashville. At the International Association of Forensic and Security Metrology conference. That's a mouthful as well. Yeah. So I want to go back and talk about some of, the intro here and just ask you about, your background. And I mean, you're from Charleston, but you started your career in the U.S. Navy. And so I was just wondering, were you always sort of had the desire to be in the Navy, the military? What was sort of your outlook when you were younger?
So, yeah, I was born in Charleston, but I was born into a Navy family. So I was a dependent at that point. So we moved around a lot. My mother is a Scottish citizen. My parents met over in Scotland when the Navy was posted my father over there. So we moved back to Scotland quite a bit. I grew up spending most of my younger years in Scotland, and between Scotland for school years and, strangely enough, on an Indian reservation during my summer time during my younger years. That's how I grew up. But I was in a military family. My older brother, when he finished high school, went into the military, became a nuke. And when I finished high school, the recruiter said the same thing. You want to be a nuke like your brother? And I said, no, I hate math. Then little did I know I'd spend up making a career out of calculations and math. But I asked at the time what was the most difficult thing they had going. And they said you could be an EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal person, a diver, a Navy diver, or a SEAL. And I said, well, which one's harder? And they said SEAL. So I said, all right, I'll raise my hand, and swore in at that point. So I do remember my dad, though, who was in Vietnam, talking about, he was a PBR, a riverboat captain, and he used to tell me stories about escorting the SEALs, taking them up river, dropping them off, coming back a few days later and picking them up. So I do remember a few of those stories, but I really didn't have a whole lot of understanding of what I was in for when I actually went into the Navy to be a SEAL.
Yeah. But I want to ask you also about the Roger Williams University, because you became a hard hat diver kind of on the side. So what is that about?
So when I was detaching from the military, there was a person in Newport, Rhode Island, who was a retired Navy SEAL from way back in the day, known as Mother Moy. He actually put Jesse Ventura through training. And Jesse Ventura, when he was the governor of Minnesota, said he was the only person he was ever scared of was Terry Moy, Mother Moy. He and I quickly became friends, and his son owned a commercial diving company. So I started working there diving and started diving in kind of an apprenticeship and got my certification for hard hat surface air supply diving. So everything from bridge inspection, I was a certified underwater bridge inspector, substructure inspector, to cutting, welding, pouring concrete, you name it. Typical construction, just at depth.
Now, is this all on the East Coast, or was it like all over the place? Where
it was all East Coast. It was all in the New England area. Yeah, bridge inspections. But while I was doing that, we'd always have conversations. We'd have cameras on our heads. We'd have full communications. But we were always having briefs before we went in the water and after we came out of the water. If we were working on a bridge or if we were working on a rail system for a dry dock system, we talked to the engineers, the PEs up topside. So for after a while, I started realizing they really need to see because the water's murky at up in the New England area.
So even with a camera, it's hard for them to see what we're doing. We do almost everything by feeling.
So I started creating 3D renderings of what I was doing underwater, believe it or not, by using Excel. And I really enjoyed doing that, to create those 3D renderings. My brother taught me that because he was so smart. He was the nuke. And how to use Photoshop and how to use Excel to create these 3D renderings. So that's when I really kind of started. And then we got into using sonar and other types of imaging underwater. So sector scans, side sonar scanning, things like that. And that's when I really piqued my interest about, hey, we can image things when we can't even see them. So
I've got to talk to you about some things after. I had no idea. I didn't know that you were doing all the side scan sonar and stuff like that. I've seen some really cool stuff where people have found, you know, vehicles in rivers and things like that. So yeah, I'll have to talk to you about that another time. What can you tell me about your time with the CIA? You spent 10 years there. I mean, what can you tell me about maybe some of your duties and things like that, what you're responsible for, if anything? And also, I just wanted to ask, like you said, after 9/11, you left. And I'm just wondering if you had like looking for other opportunities or what was the move like?
So, yeah, it wasn't 10 years. I was a contractor for approximately 10 to 11 years after the agency. I went in. I just received my undergrad and I was looking for a new job. So I was applying to Secret Service. A lot of my friends had gotten out and were making waves in the Secret Service. I applied to the FBI as an agent, and they told me I didn't have enough experience, which I thought was kind of funny. And then I applied to the agency as a whim. My roommate said, hey, you should try it. Apply to the agency. Well, they're the first ones to call me back. And I went through their pipeline. And I only spent a little over a year with them when I realized it wasn't exactly what I was looking for. And that's when I ran into more of my friends who were working with the agency and were contractors. And I then stepped out and immediately stepped into the world of contracting for the federal government.
Okay. You said like a lot of your friends, and that was do a lot of people from the military often move over or shift over like CIA and do work with FBI and that sort of thing?
Yes. Yep. We're scattered all throughout, even though we're a really small group. We're very tight in our network and we stay in touch.
Okay. So I want to ask you about your current roles and responsibility. Now you are under the operations projects unit. So I want to ask you about that. So what is, you know, the OPU and what are some of its responsibilities? You know, what is it that they do or take care of?
Sure. So we're based out of the Quantico Laboratory, which is down here in Quantico, and we fall under the forensic response section. So we respond. There's other units within this section. The operational projects unit is comprised of five programs. Our primary mission is we deploy to crime scenes. We collect those crime scenes, collect the data, bring it back, process it, and then we produce whatever is needed for trial, prosecution, and or follow-on investigations. So out of the five programs, we have a multimedia and art and design program, MADP, we call it. And that consists of forensic artists. They're the ones that do all the training and the composite sketches. They do cognitive interviews on victims and or witnesses and then develop the sketches. They're also the ones that do the artwork for age progression. So if you see the FBI's top 10 most wanted list, somebody like Whitey Bulger hasn't been seen in 10 or 20 years, they can do a progression on him to see what he looks like probably now. They also do approximations. So the lab sometimes receives skulls, Jane Does, John Does. So after anthropology takes a look at it, lets us know, hey, this is a male or a female, approximate age. We'll take that, we'll scan it with an arm scanner, a LIDAR arm scanner, and then we'll 3D print the skull so we're not actually consuming it. And then those forensic artists use their training, put in the depth markers and the tissue markers, and then reconstruct and do an approximation so you have a nice bust or head of that, what that person may have looked like. They do a whole litany of other things that are really cool in the forensic art world. We have two photographic programs under OPU, one that manages the photographers here in the building. So when evidence does come into the building, it's categorized, cataloged, and photographed. They also work with explosives unit and the firearms and tool marks unit to do high-speed videography and photography. And then the other photography program manages all the field photographers out there in the United States, all their care and feeding, all their training, all their equipment, and things like that. So having folks out in the field is a great force multiplier when we deploy to a massive scene and we need more bodies, more cameras. And I'm sure we'll talk about that soon with scanners and total stations and things like that. The newest program that we created is the Aerial Geospatial Information Program. That kind of came out of my program because my program, the Technical Design and Documentation Program, are the ones that operate the LIDAR terrestrial scanners. We're now moving into hand scanners, structured light. We're moving into SLAM technology. We were using a lot of drones, and the drone part grew so large to include an actual aerial platform, a Cessna, and all of the ESRI specifics to tie that down to the face of the earth, that we created our own program there. So it's a fantastic program, and they're doing a lot of work with creating forensic maps. And then there's my program. Like I said, we're the ones that actually go to the scenes, document using all sorts of technology and techniques with the help of all the other programs. And then I also have a shop here. So we actually build 3D physical models, or we can build special apparatus, demonstratives, you name it, whatever anybody needs.
Okay. I got a lot of questions for you then, because there's a lot of stuff there. So first off, was the OPU, I mean, I imagine I'm thinking back to, you know, way back in the day, you know, 50s, 60s or whatever, the FBI must have been creating, you know, physical reconstructions of scenes, or whether it was for JFK or something like that, right? So is OPU old? Like, has it been around a long time, or is it a more recent thing?
Not in this name. So as with any organization, whether it's government or private sector, there's always restructuring and shifting based on either budget or personnel and what people want to see or the mission at that time. So OPU has changed names. It used to be SPG, Special Projects Group, or Special Programs Group. I can't remember. And then there was the Physical Something Group. I can't. But in short, in the past, when they were just using plumb bobs and tape measures, the shop actually was used and had real craftsmen. Not that they're not real now. It's just that we do a lot of computer work now with CNC routers and 3D printers. But back in the day, they actually had furniture makers. And those furniture makers, when the FBI needed to emplace something like a listening device or something else of that nature, they would actually have somebody go in, take a picture of that furniture, whether it be a Victorian high-back chair or something, or a table or a credenza or a desk. And then the furniture makers would make it, whether it be just the leg that they would be replacing or the whole thing, and then they would go in and replace it. So that was one way of, you know, of course, all after their warrant was in place. But after a while, the furniture making started to phase out. The model making has always been kind of an in-place thing. There's lots of black and whites that I see around here on the campus of people pointing at models prepping for a raid or something else of that nature. So models have always been around, and it's strange that they're still around to this day, because everybody asks me, Steve, how are physical models still wanted or used, especially in this age of 3D? We have large HD screens in every courtroom. Now people are asking about using augmented reality and virtual reality in the jury box. So, but strangely enough, physical models are loved by a lot of prosecutors out there. And some of the best examples I can use are for, let's say, the Boston bombing. In a chaotic environment, a lot of people lose vision of their peripheral, and they just focus on either trying to survive or get out of there. So they don't remember a lot. But during witness prep or even during testimony, if they can point to a model when they see the whole thing, kind of like at a parade from up high, they can say, oh, I was in front of a building that had a red banner. Oh, that's where I was. And they can point at it. The same with the genocide trials. I forget which country, but Rwanda, I believe. We built a model for that. So if you were to show a lot of those folks an aerial image of their village, they don't know what they're looking at. But if you show them actual terrain and they can see the trees and the paths in their village, they can immediately go, oh yeah, this is where I walked. This is where the mass graves were. So they're actually used a lot, and we get requested for physical models quite often, more than I would have ever expected.
Yeah, I can see the benefit of physical models, even just, you know, some kind of device or whatever that gets recreated, and, you know, a prosecutor has it at trial. He's holding it in his hands. You know, I have a sample back here of like a scan of a person's finger with the fingerprints. You can see the ridge details and things like that. And, you know, if you give something like that to somebody to hold in their hands, just the memory, the retention, and the learning, I think it's just different. You know, some people, when they touch something, they remember it better and just differently. So I think that has a lot of benefit. So your team, I'm trying to understand how you guys get called out, how your team gets called out. So, you know, something happens, and who makes the call to say, hey, we got to get, you know, somebody from Steve's team or multiple people from Steve's team out on the road here? How does that flow work typically?
So I'll say usually, you know, it's anytime it's a federal case. That's usually right off the bat. You know, if it's a federal case, whether it be a hate crime or a color of law or something of that nature, then we're usually involved. Mass casualty, mass shooting, detonation, for example, Nashville bombing. You know, thank goodness nobody else was really killed or hurt in that except for the subject himself. But it's the field offices that have the RAs, the resident agencies out in the field, and they're the ones that have a relationship with the local PDs, the counties, the tribal, the state, and folks like that. And they're the ones that keep that really nice relationship going. So when something does happen, they're immediately by their side and say, hey, do you need help? You know, if it wasn't immediately, hey, this is a federal case. Whether it be resources, whether it be assistance, anything of that nature, and it's not just from the laboratory. If they do request assistance, that request then goes straight from that RA or field office through their evidence response team lead, ERT, to our ERTU, which is out here, your evidence response team unit. And they're the ones that kind of notify all of us folks that are involved with the lab shooting reconstruction team, the LSRT. At that point, we hold a phone call. We go over what, you know, hey, what is it we're looking at? How big is it? What's the complexity of it? That's when we can decide how many people we need to get out there, or if we need to go out at all, if there's going to be trajectories, if they can see anything on site. I mean, it's similar, very similar to what almost all local PDs do. We don't do anything different. It's just sometimes it's at a grander scale.
Right. Okay. And like the way you're like in terms of training and that sort of thing, because you guys are handling so many different types of potential cases and different types of scenarios, do you have people on your team that sort of, I'm sure they are cross-trained on a lot of different things, but do they specialize as well in certain areas? So some people take the lead in certain things?
Yeah, we do. So We also, so not only do we deploy and we do all the work, but we also are the, I guess you could say, the teachers. So we have to become adjunct faculty and go through training to be instructors for the FBI, because we have operators come to us and then we put on the instruction for using LIDAR scanners, terrestrial LIDAR scanners, for using drones, for using cameras in general. So we have the instructors, and also total stations. So we do all of that instruction ourselves. So we teach in-house. So yes, we do have people in my program that are lead for total station, because that is in itself pretty technical and complex. And we have three levels of training: beginner, intermediate, and advanced. And then same with scanning, we have our beginner and our new intermediate. So I have a lead for that program. And then we have a lead for the drone program that's under AGIP. And so all of that stuff. So yeah, but there is some, we do help each other because we're not that big. We do help each other when it comes to delivering instruction. And actually, when it comes to creating products, so the charts, the diagrams, the fly-throughs, the videos, the timelines, all of that stuff, even the 3D digital models, all of us have some level of skill when it comes to using Adobe or Autodesk.
Right, right. So I guess a couple of things to mention. And one is that actually your team is looking for someone. I was going to mention this later, but let's bring it up. We're talking about training and team, but maybe you want to say something about that now. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll put it, I guess it's a shameless plug, but yeah, we are hiring. We're looking for personnel for the AGIP program. So ESRI experience using ArcMapper or anything of that nature, ArcGIS, is going to be crucial there. I'm looking for one person right now and another person in a few weeks. And Autodesk is probably my primary experience requirement there. We can train you on everything else. I mean, I'll train you on how to use every machine in the shop and build stuff. But my primary thing is somebody needs to know how to draw lines using Autodesk and CAD.
There you go, folks. Yep. Forensics Talks is now a human resources show, too. There you go. All right. Okay, let's talk about scene documentation. We were kind of touching on it, whatever. What kinds of options do you have in terms of technology for mapping scenes? Because I know you guys, well, I guess you can get some of the smaller scenes, but I imagine when you get called, you know, when it's like bullet trajectories or something, it's not three or four shots. It could be 50, 60, or maybe even thousands. I don't know.
Yeah, there have been a couple of scenes in the thousands. So the first thing we do is we try to make sure we know what we're walking into. And that's where we rely on our new geospatial folks. They immediately have access to several different databases of aerial and satellite imagery, and they'll put that to a scale and send it to us, so we know what we're looking at, if it's a townhouse, if it's an open barn, if it's in the woods, whatever. Because sometimes we do like to move our response vehicles out there, which are large pierce trucks. If it's a complex scene, we're going to take our, we call it the MIP, the mobile imaging platform. It's just a large pierce truck that all of us can sit in and have computers and actually do all of our work, whether it be registering or different types of things, downloading photographs. So that's the first thing we do, is we get an idea of where we're going. And then once we get there, we do a walkthrough, and hopefully there's a sketch of the scene. If not, first thing I tell everybody is look for the nearest fire exit, and hopefully there's a plan on the wall. You rip it off the wall, and that's your new scene sketch. And then we'll use that, copy that out of the MIP. We have copiers and large format plotters. And we start planning our attack on that scene, documentation. So depending on the scene and how quickly we get there or how quickly we're called, there may be human remains. There may not be human remains. The ME may have already been there, or the coroner, whichever. And they may have removed all of the victims before we get there. Sometimes they don't. So if they don't, then we tried to, because we consider that transitory, we try to make sure we document them in place as much as possible. But the nice thing is, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I was just going to ask about your choice of how you approach the scene as well. So you get an overview of what's going on. And I mean, I know you guys have all kinds of different equipment at your disposal. So I'm just curious about how you choose who is going to use what. I mean, do you always use a mix of this stuff when you're on scene, or do you all, you know, try to use all the same piece of equipment or something like that? You know, how do you divide a large scene?
So the nice thing is, it wasn't until about 2018, up until 2018, only my team was using scanners in the FBI. So when we go to a scene, for example, San Bernardino or the Pulse or even Las Vegas, there'd be one guy or two guys with one scanner, and it would take weeks. Now that we've put the scanners out to the field, we can show up with, I believe, for Nashville bombing, we had, I can't remember how many scanners, but we did almost the whole downtown city, literally in a couple of days, and it was amazing. So that now also with the drones. So we force multiplied all of our technologies. We're pushing drones out to the field. So they're actually collecting before we even show up. So they have a really nice ortho mosaic by the time we show up. When we do show up, we start coordinating all the other scanners that show up. And then we hit it. Hey, you take this sector. We'll divide the scene up. You take this part. You take this part. And we'll have one person that's putting it all together and registering it. Same with Total Station. We have Total Station teams out there. So we've got about 30 scan teams out there, 30, 31 Total Station teams, and about 30 drone teams out there as well. But also the locals will have the same capability. Love working with DPS down in Texas. They're highway patrol folks. They show up and they can throw down, because they're so used to doing accidents and crimes or accident scenes, that their Total Station work is absolutely amazing. So I love getting that stuff from them. And then I'll have the Rangers doing scans with their scanners. So they kind of get all that, because they're usually the first on scene. And that's the first thing I do on a phone call when I'm talking to the person that on the scene who's doing a walkthrough, giving us the description. It's like, hey, if somebody is there with a scanner, tell them to start scanning. Just general overlay scans. Same with Total Station. So by the time we show up, we're more focused on making sure everything was covered, but also primarily on the trajectory work, which takes a lot more time. And we're doing a lot more high quality resolution scans too.
Okay. I know for a while you were using the Total Station for bullet trajectory documentation. Do you still do that, or is it laser scan, or is it a mix of things?
It's a mix. We used to do, so most of our trajectory is done with rods. And that's done by our firearms and tool marks unit. So they're the ones that identify the holes, the impacts, the skips, and the trajectories. And then we just document it and create the products to support their report. So we used to use Total Station, obviously, to identify the hole or the impact or the skip. But then when there was a rod, they used to also shoot in the tip of the rod. So now you can go connect one to the other. But hitting that rod with a single laser point is sometimes difficult. And sometimes you miss. A lot of times you miss. And sometimes you'll hit something else instead. So we've moved away from that. And we actually scan the rods now.
Okay, got it. Yeah. I just want to make sure, because I got a lot of questions, but let me move on to the multimedia art and design section. You mentioned before about the forensic facial imaging and doing sketches and things like that. So is there like a dedicated team of people who are specialized in that, or are you also somebody that works on the facial imaging?
So it's actually managed by the multimedia art and design program, the forensic artist part. Who do all the composite sketching and the forensic facial approximation and stuff like that. But we do have, so when people come to OPU, whether they're working for me or the photography group, if they have a natural talent for portraiture or some other type of anatomy sketching, then we test them under the art program. And if they are pretty good, then we start doing the follow-on training with them. So after a while, I'd say a year or so, if they think they're good enough, then they'll deploy with an expert composite sketcher or forensic artist to make sure they're doing it correctly. And then after a few of those, then they're on their own. So it's nice that we kind of overlap in our programs if people have specific talents. And that goes for drone operators as well. So AGIP actually controls the drone operators and they manage it. But there are drone operators that are in each of the programs who have taken an interest in.
And you said that, you know, for example, if you do find like a skull or something like that, you'll scan it. You'll produce like a 3D model, a 3D print of it, and then people will work on it, right? So you obviously, you must have a fantastic facility for like 3D printing and that sort of thing. Do you have a, lot of different types of machines at your disposal?
I wouldn't say a lot of different types, but under my program, we have the OPU shop, and it's about a 3,000 square foot shop. And I have two 3D printers, commercial grade. They are FFD, fused filament deposition. So it's just, and we just use regular ABS plastic in black, white, or gray. So, I mean, because we're making models that, and furniture for the models or anything else that's organic in shape, in particular skulls, we can paint if needed. But the skulls are going to be covered in clay anyway, so there's no need. All we care about is the accuracy of that scan and then print. And they're pretty darn accurate. So I have a couple of 3D printers, CNC router table. We use sign foam. It's a 5x8 capability, so we can throw down a large sheet. We can do plywood. Other types of wood, but sign foam is usually what we use. It's 2-inch high density, lightweight foam. And we can carve out a lot of geospatial data on that. So we use that as the footprint for some of our, for a lot of our models, instead of doing the old train diorama version, which is used to be done not too long ago, where they would actually draw contour lines on stacked insulation foam and shave it out over a couple of days. So now we just carve it out on a CNC router, leave a footprint for the model that we build out of acrylic, plexiglass, or 3D print, and cover it with all your typical grass and trees and things like that.
You mentioned the like showing people like their village, and you know, if it was in Rwanda or something like that. So you get terrain and you dress it up with like little trees and stuff like that. Do you do things like reconstruct models of weapons or, you know, improvised devices and things like this?
Yep. We replicate a lot of stuff, whether it be for demonstratives, for trial or prosecution, or we make special apparatus for folks here in the laboratory building to continue their examinations. So scraping tables, we'll fabricate scraping tables, we'll floating tables for their microscopes. We've made replica weapons for training courses so the photographers can practice pulling serial numbers off of them. We made a replica machete once for trial, so it actually wouldn't cut people when they, you know, had it in the courtroom. Although I will argue that a acrylic machete is just as dangerous sometimes as a metal machete if you're swinging it. But yeah, so we do a lot of other really fun stuff with ongoing investigations to support those investigations. Everything from making fake radioactive slugs to one time we made a white phosphorus generator. We made a train derailment apparatus to see if we could actually derail a train. We make fake money. We'll order fake money, stuff it into a posse box to demonstrate at trial that this is what, you know, for a white collar corruption, this is what it looked like when they received the $50,000. Lots of fun stuff. We do all sorts of stuff. So we have a full metal shop and a full wood shop. We work plastics, and it's fun.
That's interesting. So you'll actually run tests. So you'll like the derailment or whatever, you'll actually try to recreate or try to create something like that too, which is kind of interesting. It's not just a demonstrative. It's actually, you're running some testing as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We work with explosives unit. We'll make them or fabricate dummies for them for explosive testing. And then which is nice being here on Quantico, we can just go out to the explosive ranges, set up the range. And then what we'll do is prior to that is we'll total station everything in, so we know where everything is. They'll do the explosive test, and then we total station all of the debris and, you know, what the seat and the impact was. So they can use that as intent. This is what would have happened if this explosive went off, or this is the recreation of the RPG when it hit the Humvee, etc.
I wanted to ask you about photography and the importance of photography in your group, because, you know, people are still taking photographs, and I mean, photographs are on drones. Photographs can be used for, you know, reconstructing things with, you know, photogrammetry packages and things like that. So what can you tell me about the group that handles the photography, what you're doing with photography, and what the program is like there?
I can't tell you a whole lot because I don't manage them. I do know that the high-speed videography and photography part is critical here. It's one of the best programs we have going, especially with working with firearms and explosives unit. Having the photographers in the field, the field photographers, is critical as well, because the photographer, a photograph is a photograph. The other thing they do, not other than just regular crime scene photography, is spherical photography. So this day and age, it's really easy to run out there with a hemispherical camera and just snap, 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 and it comes with the software to stitch it together. Our folks use tripods and a regular SLR, mirrorless, or, you know, the old DSLR, and we'll actually do three or four positions on the tripod, because the spherical photography from those cameras is a lot higher resolution, and the packages they can put together are really, really nice. So they're custom packages. But it is getting harder with all of the technology that's out there. I mean, the camera sensors are getting a lot higher quality, and I'm glad I'm not a photographer, because I'd be wondering, how do I keep up with or stay ahead of the technology as it is now?
Yeah, you said the old DSLR. It's like, oh my God, DSLRs are old already. And, yeah, and you're right. You're right. Right, mirrorless is coming out. All these 360 cameras. There's so much more to photography. And I've seen some presentations actually from people at the FBI. Tony, who did, I think it was the Aurora Theater shooting, and he showed me some amazing images of, you know, these bullet trajectories and how he was able to capture them. So I thought it was like super. Some really very professional work in documentation. So you're working alongside these people sometimes, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we work hand in hand with them. So in fact, we try to make sure we cover every single piece of evidence, whether it be actual evidence or trajectory or ballistic evidence, something of that nature. So we developed a sticker that actually has a checkoff or a signature for every discipline, whether that be total station, measured, scanned, and photography, to come through and make sure they check. So you can imagine where there are thousands of rounds that have been fired, there's a lot of stickers. So, but you have to keep very long spreadsheets of every single impact, hole, and skip. And we need to make sure they always stay categorized and in the proper order.
How has technology impacted your group, you know, over the time that you've been there? I mean, has it, when did you start? 2014. I mean, we're getting up the, yeah. And so there's, you know, almost 10 years. And so, I mean, have you seen a big shift in the technology? Do you feel like it's more rapid now than it was before? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So one of the biggest things I've noticed is photogrammetry is, the latest study I saw come out of, I think it was MIT, showed that in a closed environment, photogrammetry is as accurate, if not better, than LIDAR. So when we're talking about up close and personal to something, I don't think it's that case yet with standoff distances or even aerial when it comes to LIDAR. LIDAR has so much more benefit with regard to penetrating canopies and giving you a bare earth model compared to photogrammetry. And of course, photogrammetry, you're always dependent on light. You have to have light for those photographs. So when you cut to a scene and it is pitch black and you don't have lights, or you don't want to throw up huge hot spots that burn out certain areas, you can set up your scanner and just scan away in total darkness and still walk away with a great product. But photogrammetry is definitely screaming along. And to see where scanning has gone from the time I started in 2014, it's faster, lighter, more detail, and now it's moving to hand scanning with structured light. and waveform return, and just the distances that smaller scanners are reaching is absolutely amazing. And now you're getting hybrid photogrammetry and LiDAR in one sensor these days, which is absolutely amazing. So it's going to get to the point. I mean, you know, I will say it's funny. I was training and practicing using the iPad the other day, and I looked at my phone and your message came up with, hey, the LiDAR on an iPhone or an iPad heats up. And so I was like, oh, let me try this. And I was out in the sunlight, and sure enough, and there was no case on the iPad, and it was still roasting hot. But just the fact that I can do something like that with a $2,000 instrument, you know, it all depends on what your objective is, you know, your level of error and accuracy in the end, or what your time on target is going to be. So you've got your trade-offs either way, but the technology is advancing very rapidly.
So is your team also responsible for like researching new technologies, testing new technologies, putting them into, you know, validation studies as well?
Yeah. So we have a small group in OPU that's the leads of each of my programs, to include photography, are always looking forward into different software applications that can make things processes faster, different instruments that can make things faster. But we do that hand in hand with the evidence response team unit. They have a small R&D group as well, because they're the ones that pay for all the field technology. So we decide usually what it should be, and we educate them on how to use it. But the folks down at ERTU are the ones that actually purchase it. So they have a heavy hand in figuring out what's next.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, managing cases and working on these cases, because some of them are fairly large. Some of them are tragic, right? There's a lot of, you know, loss of life and things like that. And so, you know, obviously you and your team, you know, may be exposed to certain things, you know, that are not always the most pleasant. So, and this topic has come up a lot before, but I'm just wondering how you guys manage the stress or the impact of some of these scenes. And, you know, is it the team itself that's, you know, often very open and close? I've seen a lot of places where, for example, humor plays a big part in, you know, just sort of relieving some stress, but, you know, just the whole stress of working in these kinds of conditions, and, you know, how you manage all of that.
Yeah. So I have some level of understanding of working in a small, tight, cohesive group, being from the SEAL teams, where you really form a really tight bond with somebody that you share a lot of misery with. It does translate to this job somewhat, because you do find yourself at some really traumatic scenes. And it could be for 2-3 days, or it could be for 2 weeks. And as a lot of people out there that work scenes, the smells, the sights, the sounds are all things that can creep back into your memory, no matter where you are, if you're out with your family, something like that. So because of what we do, the folks in OPU are fairly tight. It's a very small, tight team. And you're right, some call it the dark humor. You know, you've got to joke about it to kind of stay light. We do watch each other to some degree to make sure we're, you know, especially while on scene, hey, are you okay? Are all things? And there are some things that I know here in OPU, we try not to expose certain people to, you know, especially if you're a parent or if you're a mother of certain children of a certain age, then they're not going to work a certain case. And then the Bureau itself has programs in place that, you know, we always are looking into or trying to take advantage of for those who, you know, come back with a little more on their shoulders than expected.
Yeah. Now, do you also do work, for example, overseas? Because there could be incidents that happen that may be related overseas or internationally. Is that something that your group has to handle as well?
Not all the time, but yes, from time to time, when an American citizen is involved in something overseas, for instance, a composite sketch, we've sent folks overseas for that, and for other things
some different things. So in some of the scenes that you've been working, I'm curious about, I'm being careful not to ask like really specifics, but I'd like to know what maybe some of the things that you've learned or some of the things that you've seen that your work brings value, like how your work brings value, or you're always maybe surprised about something when you document it, or maybe you figure something out or you realize something was, you know, visible or present that maybe wasn't before. Like, have you had any of those moments that were like, damn, like that's pretty cool that we were able to do that?
So one, the value, I'd say when we do tours here or something of that nature, I always talk about the composite sketch artists and how if we ever get hits on the composite sketches, they like to keep those mugshots next to the composite sketch. You know, it's kind of like, hey, we got this one. And so there are a lot of those hits around those forensic artists' cubicles, and it's fantastic. The same with any cases that our products are used in, whether it be digital, whether it be physical, and it's a successful case, then yeah, it's all worth it in the end. I mean, the months it takes to build a product or develop a product, and it finally goes to trial, whether we testify or not, which at times we do testify, but it's all worth it if it's a successful trial. And yeah, without getting into too much, but it's fantastic. So yeah, there's some things that you can figure out. I mean, just for example, Murder on the High Seas, when a vessel sinks in 2,000 feet of water and the company went out of business the same year that vessel was made, but the prosecution team is asking for a model of that vessel, so they can describe, a naval engineer can describe how it had to be rigged to sink and show intent. So we find a vessel that's very close to it, the only other one in the world. We scan it, we bring it back, and then we use the insurance pictures to make sure everything fits. And then we create this amazing model for trial that can come completely apart and found guilty. And because they were able to describe exactly what they were asking for. So working with prosecutors and AUSAs and folks like that to tell the story and say, hey, this is what we're hoping to evoke using this diagram or this timeline. It's fantastic when it's used and they come back to us and say, that's what nailed it. You know, that's what secured that plea or that trial. So it's really worth it.
Have you guys experimented or are you looking at implementing, or maybe you already have, but you know, the whole virtual reality thing, I mean, is it a tool that is currently, you know, in use? Is there still some resistance to it, or, you know, is it horses out of the barn?
So it's, when I first showed up here in 2014, I was involved with a working group, and it's actually being developed almost kind of like all around me, but not with me. Which is fine because they're using it, looking at it in the tactical realm. They're looking at it in the counteroffensive realm. They're looking at all sorts of different areas. But with regard to us, people keep asking, "Hey, couldn't you see everybody in a jury box wearing a HoloLens or something so you can take them to the scene, or they can walk around in the model or things like that?" And I think immediately, because I've tried it a few times, you'd have to make sure that all those folks in the jury box, one, are immune to having migraines and probably won't get motion sickness or throw up or something. And who knows, because the general juror, you never know what you're going to get. And it would have to be very well managed and led, because if you put people in a HoloLens in a model, you're going to have people wandering over here looking at this. And so it would definitely have to be well managed.
Yeah, for sure. There's still some challenges there, especially with full, you know, 6 degrees of freedom, virtual reality in a jury. I can see all kinds of issues actually happening there. But it is an interesting approach, especially for like witness perspectives and things like that, the things that virtual reality can do really well. Hopefully we'll see some more of that coming in the future. One thing I saw when we... last time we saw each other was in North Carolina, but so it was at the ACER conference, and it was interesting. It's the first time I saw the FBI giving out brochures, and one of these, it wasn't for hiring purposes, but it was because you were, you know, trying to show what it was that your team was doing, and the fact that your team is available to other police agencies when they need help. And I thought you may want to talk about that.
Yeah, so one of the groups that have here at the Academy it's not just new agents. We also have the FBI National Academy, which a lot of local police departments, county, tribal, you name it, and state can all attend for certain disciplines. And so we always give them a tour of our shop. And at the end, we tell them, hey, all of these resources that we have here are available to you for free. And we still do that currently. We're making several models right now for prosecutors in South Carolina. Alabama just called me, the old Southern Boy Network, South Carolina told Alabama, hey, contact these guys. We'll come down, do a cold case. We'll scan the residents, make a digital model or a diagram for them so they can use it in trial. But yeah, OPU is available. And in fact, I'd say quite a lot of our work is local assist. Locals either don't have the resources to total station, do a survey of a hill in front of a house where somebody took a shot and said they fell and there was a hole. And so we'll come out, we'll survey the entire front lawn and say, no, there's no hole, or he had to have shouldered the weapon, or we don't say that, but we provide the data for them. So yeah, it's a big thing for us. We enjoy helping the locals, however we can. And it's free.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I said the big F word, it's free, yeah. Right? Yep. So, you know, there's several people I know on here that are from different police agencies. And, you know, if you ever need help, I think this is an incredible service that you can call and get some assistance, you know, especially if you're a smaller agency and you don't have all the resources that, you know, the Steve's team has. So that's pretty awesome. So Steve, so what is next for you and the team? Like, are you looking to get into different areas? Are you looking to do different things in the near future? You know, what kinds of things, can you talk about with your team and, you know, where you're headed and where you're going?
Well, one, I just need more bodies. So, yeah, we want to keep our numbers up, but, definitely want to keep working in the realm of crime scene reconstruction. My three biggest things is technology. How quickly can we get there? And with all the tools and technology we have, so we have to get to X. So I'm always looking forward to what is the newest technology? How can we make that faster, more efficient? And then time on target. It's a phrase obviously I've brought over, but how fast can we document that scene? Because we run into that a lot, especially with major scenes in major cities, is, hey, we need to get this road back open back up. Hey, we need to get downtown open back up. So a lot of times when you ask, how do we attack a scene or how do we even begin? We'll always try to work from the outside in, especially if there's parking lots involved, we'll work from the outside in just so they can open streets back up. Until we get it right down to the nitty gritty of, you know, the central part of that scene where the final shootout may have occurred or something of that nature. But so whatever it is, I need to reduce time on target. So if that's technology, if that's processes, we're always looking to improve those. And then production. I need to, how quickly can we produce things? How well can we produce things? And then how well can we testify to that production? So there is a lot of technology out there that can do things really quickly, but we need to testify to those things. We don't testify. We don't write reports. We're not examiners. We're factual witnesses. So, you know, a foot is a foot to us. 2 meters is 2 meters. We testify to our training, how it was collected and the proper techniques and how it was produced and things like that. But so those three things are big for me. We always try to improve and move forward with that. Technology in the shop. We love the fact that we're doing all sorts of fun things. I have 4 laser systems that are very large, 5x8 sheet type laser systems that I cut all our plywood and acrylic on. And we're doing a lot of standoff LED work. We're doing a lot of the lasers are getting better and better all the time. We're actually looking at printing. So we have a vinyl shop as well. So we can print vinyl. We help a lot of the units out with different markings and different vinyl for walls. But we also use it when we do make models that we can replicate the logos and the signage of a jurisdiction. So when we do a vehicle like a police car, we can replicate that. But it's a constant upkeep with technology. So printing on solid substrates or printing directly to metal, things like that, is always something we're trying to keep up with. So.
Yeah. How do you, you mentioned, you know, testifying at trial, and that's obviously has to be part of your role, right? You have to authenticate your work.
Yep. I mean, you know, several of my folks that have testified several times. It's back to how were you trained? What's your background? How did you collect this data? Was it collected appropriately? You know, were you trained to collect it? And then how did you process it? And of course, we also go into the theories behind each of the technologies that, you know, collect the data and things like that. So we may be considered expert witness, but it's factual witness. It's not any of the, well, in my 80 years of experience, I believe I have a 90%, you know, comfort rate. No, that's 2 meters. You can tell because we put a NIST artifact down that's 2 meters long. So it's kind of nice in that regard.
Yeah, sorry. There's a question here from somebody, and I won't bring it up, but I'll basically ask it. But it had to do with, you know, 3D replicas and 3D prints and things like this. And how do you authenticate something like that in court? Have you had to authenticate, you know, the model is, you know, accurate to a certain scale or a smaller scale? It's an accurate replica. How do you typically explain that at trial?
We can scale things up. It depends on what they're asking for. It can be a 1-to-1. We can scale items up if they want to pass it through the jury box. For example, if it's something very small, like a morphine syringe and it needs to be read, we can make it a lot larger, or we can scale things down. But that's basically what we try to, if we were to testify to that, we would explain how things are scaled. I mean, it's kind of that simple.
Right. Yeah, no, I get it. Well, look, Steve, we're getting on here. And again, I want to thank you very much. If somebody wants to reach out, or if somebody maybe is interested in the position, or maybe somebody is interested in, you know, they're like, hey, I'm calling Steve's team up because I got some work for them, you know, local PD or something. What is the best place to reach you at?
My email, S. Jameson. So it's Sierra and then Jameson, like the whiskey, Jameson. At FBI.gov.
Okay. So if you have an inquiry or they want to submit a CV or something like that, they can get a hold of you. And I think are you on LinkedIn as well? I thought you were on LinkedIn.
I am on LinkedIn. Yep.
Okay. So people can get a hold of you there as well. Excellent.
Yep. And under my profile, I'm looking for.
Yeah. It might be cryptic, but you'll find them. Right. So right on. Well, listen, Steve, thank you so much. You know, thank you to Aaron. Thanks to the team. I wish you guys all the best. I hope to see you sometime soon as well. But I appreciate you being here today. And like I said, we'll be in touch.
All right. Thanks, Eugene. I appreciate it.
All right. Cheers. Okay, folks, that does it for this one. Another forensics talk, some interesting work there done by the FBI and their team using a whole bunch of different technologies and really cool stuff. So we are going to be back next week. So make sure you're here. I'll be announcing that probably tomorrow, putting something online. So you'll see we'll be talking about gait analysis, something I haven't discussed as well. So, hey, everybody, have a happy Thursday. See you soon. Bye-bye.